Ladies and gentlemen, what the fuck is up? We're back. Season 3 is going to be a fucking kick-ass ride. And guess what? We're still in a pandemic. We're still all wearing masks. Half the world is out of a job. But bad news is still here. First guest, third season. Man, I hope you're ready for a treat. Michael Voltaggio, one of the most famous chefs in the world. I mean, we could start off with how many awards this man has. The AAA 5 Award, the Diamond Award, the Mobile 5-Star Award. Most of all, a Michelin star. The biggest fucking rating you could possibly ever get in a restaurant. GQ, best new restaurant. Come on, the list goes on and on. This kid is a genius with food. One of my dear friends. He's got an amazing story. Won the show Top Chef. The list is so long for me to even talk about. I want you to tune in, put your headphones on, go on a run, listen to this man's story. His advice on life is amazing. He's someone I call every time I need any sort of advice. He's come from absolutely nothing, working from like a dishwashing kid to creating art with food. Him and his brother own a bunch of businesses together. It's an amazing story. He worked under Jose Andres, one of the most famous chefs in the world as well. I promise I won't let you down with this one, guys. I hope everyone's enjoying their Sunday. I hope everyone's keeping their head right and tight. This thing will hopefully be over one day, and we all laugh about it together. Happy Sunday to my Bad News Army, the Bad News family. Matt and I appreciate you guys. Keep following us, and we love you guys. Thank you so much.
Hey, yo, bad news. Fuck going on? That's just terrible.
Bad news.
I can't believe it.
Bad news.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Bad news.
You guys got me?
Yep. Woo, look at that.
We did it.
That guy.
Fucking 3 earthquakes last night. I haven't gone to sleep since that shit happened.
I just are we recording? I just people have been texting me all morning.
Yo, we're just laying in bed last night, and I just had a dream about like somebody knocking a beehive down in my backyard. So I woke up from that, and I finally got myself like back to sleep, and then all of a sudden the whole bed just like shook. So I woke up and thought I was still dreaming. So I looked at my girlfriend, I'm like, did you feel the earthquake? And she's like, yes. And I'm like, oh. Like I thought I was straight, like still dreaming.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Were you good?
No, I can't.
Hold on. Hold on one sec.
The audio is okay though, right?
Yeah. We can hear you. We're just trying to make sure we're recording and everything.
You doing this at your house?
Yeah, this is my little office. The Palms is closed, so we can't even enter.
Oh, again? They shut everything back down?
Well, we never opened.
That's smart.
Yeah, I mean, it's the smartest move right now, man. Like, this city is like, you know, there's no big groups, there's no entertainment to be lived on. You know, so
it's just people that are not following the suggestions of the CDC that are out doing it right now.
100%. It's kind of messed up. Well, how big were the
earthquakes? Have you guys had any conversations about opening or no?
Yeah, of course. We talk about it every day. It's just, look, the boys have been in business for 40 years. You know, they know the city better than anyone.
Yeah.
And they're like, look, no entertainment, no big groups. We're not on the strip. You know, I get it. So do we want to leave for a sec?
I don't think so.
Sorry, Mike.
No worries, man. I got you guys for an hour and a half. So
I like your background as it's it looks like the earthquake just cracked it all down.
Right. That was a solid wall this morning.
It was a solid wall this morning. Are you still biking?
Yeah, I haven't been getting outside much, but I got that Peloton, and I think it's been keeping me like where I should be.
Peloton, I've been cracking pretty hard on it.
It's the best. Like it's, we ordered it like right before the like 5 month waiting list shit happened.
Dude, it didn't take 5 months, but it took like a good 13 weeks.
Yeah, but it's worth it. I mean, it's the best. It's the most convenient exercise you could have, you know? You take the classes or you just kind of go out and cruise on your own?
I have been taking classes.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
You like the Alex T?
I've been doing this girl, Jessica, and this other girl. She sounds like she's from like Trinidad. Oh, there we go. That was it.
And we're good. I wouldn't even have known what to do.
Whew,
Mike, meet Matt.
What's up, Matt?
Nice to meet you, Mike. I think we met at Family Fest.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. Well, we're back. We got we're doing an amazing episode of Bad News on our Zoom series. We got Michael Voltaggio here.
Oh yeah.
King of style, dude. He's just got the so look fresh, at him. He's just always looking fresh.
I've never seen
it. I woke up like this.
That's how I rolled out of bed. Fresh.
I wish I could wake up like that. Got the Stevan Oriol sweatshirt with some cool little, just like little diamond little things. Cool little
necklace. Did you watch that doc?
Of course.
Dude, so. Oh man.
Of course, man.
And we had
I've gotten tattooed by cartoon and just. I'll actually look at these things. A little striptease for you guys.
Yep. Oh,
so I did both of these and getting tattooed by those guys. And if you see these,
yeah,
the smile and I'll cry later.
Yeah.
I'm sitting at Cartoon's house and there's like no numbing cream or anything like that. And it's just, you just had to, like, I had to like just sit Take there it. And like straight yeah. face it. Like, and so after he finished the first one, I'm like, maybe I'm just happy. I don't need to cry later. I'll just keep the smile now mask. And not
I don't know if I need two sides.
You know what? I actually really like just this.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm good with this one side. That's
So Toons has a heavy hand?
It's not that. It's just like the intimidation factor of knowing all the like people that he's tattooed. And like, I wasn't going to roll into his crib and be like, hey, you mind if we numb up before we get started? Like, 50's back is like that big tattooed. Like, I'm getting these two things, but they're on my ribs. So,
dude,
like,
that... Trust me, when I before Norm passed away, when he was doing my Will Rise, I had Baby Ray come sit on my stomach, and he's a fucking legend, bro. Like Cartoon and all of them like started together, and like Baby Ray is like Baby fucking Ray from LA, yeah. You know. So he's sitting on me. He's like, "Don't be such a bitch, homie." And I was like, "I'm not," but
it's as we weird. Get older, it just hurts even more. Yeah.
Oh yeah, now I'm just like, "You want to get tatted?" I'm like, "Maybe later." You know,
I got I actually got tattooed a few days ago, and I blasted this man. I'm just taking all my clothes off.
Please take them off. I told you, the king of style, everyone.
So I don't know if you can see this, but
Oh yeah. I saw you post. Yep, yeah. I saw you post.
Super
that.
Cool. With, like the mask. 2020
Who did that?
My buddy Jason Storrs. He's got Lincoln Tattoo Company, and like during the they got shut. They were open, then they got shut down. Then they opened and now it's all shut down again. So like, you know, talking about business and stuff like that, it's like this exercise, this fire drill of like opening and closing is costing everyone so much more money.
So much money.
Yeah. It's like, it's better to just stay open or stay closed. And so, I mean, not just restaurants, but every business is going through that type of shit. And so I managed to squeeze in that little window where they were like allowed to be open, but it was like, all right, I don't know, like every conversation I have, it's like, I don't know when the next time I'm gonna see you again. Like my daughter was out here a couple weeks ago,
right?
And she spent a week out here with me, and that like that hug goodbye, that like, it's like, you know, you don't know
anything. It's
it's crazy.
So we got Michael Voltaggio, coolest last name. Let's start. Mike, there's so many things. Just for those that don't know, Mike is a very, 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 very famous chef. He won one of the biggest shows of all time called Top Chef. That's like, as it goes past the screen, it's because that's how big of an honor it is. And we'll talk about all that. Mike's been a friend of mine for a while now. And I was so stoked when he said yes to Matt and I to do the Bad News podcast. Mike, where are you from?
I grew up in a town called Frederick, Maryland, which is like 40 miles north of Washington, D.C. I've been in L.A. now for, it'll be 12 years this month.
Wow, 12 years.
Yeah.
When did you start cooking?
Yeah. I started cooking when I was like 15 years old at the Holiday Inn, actually.
Really?
My brother was the sous chef there in Maryland, yeah. And, you know, we weren't like a wealthy family or anything like that. And so you see kids like getting new clothes and like you're approaching that driving age and all that sort of stuff. So I got a job working for my brother as a line cook where he was actually the sous chef until we got in a small little fist fight one day. And then we went like that. But now we're partners.
They're so partners. Yeah, of course. Yeah. How long did you guys not talk for?
I mean, I was like 15, 16 right. years old, but we got in a fight at work. And I remember the food and beverage director took me into the office and was like, look, at home, you guys are family, whatever it is. But at work, you have to respect the fact that Brian's the boss. So I waited for Brian at home that night. When he came home, I'm like, yo, at work, I respect that you're the boss. But at home, and I just hit him because he was like riding me so bad at work. I'm like, why are you fucking with me? Like, what about all these? But it was a Holiday Inn, but I was taking it that seriously.
Right.
We were like, we were already in it at that age. And from then on, like, he whooped my ass after that. And I had an understanding, like, he's the boss no matter what. But like that dynamic of understanding leadership, and it doesn't matter, like, you take the personal part out of it, you got to be professional.
Wow, that's fucking crazy. How many places in Maryland were you cooking at, like, growing up? Like, yes. What was like your like first, like,
I mean, I guess, my quick trajectory, it would have been, so I went from that job to having to decide if I was going to go to culinary school. I didn't have the money really to do that at the time. So I got into this apprenticeship program at this resort called Greenbrier, which is in the middle of the mountains in West Virginia. And when you get there, you have nothing to do. Like, there's a local bar, but there was a joke there. Like, some of the guys there take advantage of the local bar, which there's one. And some people that go through that program use the facilities there to just teach themselves and learn from the property on how to cook. And so, like, even in the wintertime, in the off season, I would work as a deer butcher in a processing plant where the hunters would go out and shoot animals. And I would stand inside of a walk-in refrigerator all winter long for like $11 an hour, wearing gloves and everything bundled up, like cutting these animals up, just trying to become a better butcher, but also to survive. Like, I was making $11 an hour and like starting my life out.
How old are you on that at that time?
Yeah, how long did you spend in
that? I was 19 years old when I was doing that. And then when I hit 20, that's when I found out that I was going to be having my first daughter. And right. So imagine living in West Virginia in the mountains, starting your career, making $11 an hour. And oh, by the way, congratulations, it's a girl. Like, it's like shit got real.
Yeah. Fast. Did that kind of like just spark a thing in you, like where like your hustle game had to like kind of change where you're like, I got to fucking provide now?
That was my first introduction to like luxury. And I'd never got to experience that growing up that much. So for me, it was like, not only do I want to work at this level, but I want to be a guest at this level one day. So after that, like seeing like all the fancy chandeliers and like cooking the food and doing all that stuff, I knew like I wanted to be a part of that process, but I also wanted to experience that process. And then from there, I worked in New York for a little bit and then went down to Florida and worked at the Ritz-Carlton, where I worked for a chef named Arnaud. And he came from like Ducasse and all those guys. And this was back like sous vide cooking had just first became a thing. Like, it wasn't even talked about. Arnaud had one of those immersion circulators. We ordered it from a medical lab company. And they're like, from Pennsylvania. They're like, you guys are going to do what with this? And we're like, oh, don't worry, just send it to us. And we had to hide it from the health department. And we were doing something that we didn't know was going to become like a staple, like a basic cooking technique right. that would be utilized throughout the industry. We were doing it like in the back where no one could see it. And then from there, I worked with Charlie Palmer for a number of years, Jose Andres.
By the way, I had a night with you and Jose Andres in Miami. That was the craziest shit I've ever experienced.
He's got more energy than any human being I've ever met. The guy just doesn't turn off. And I think that, I mean, I don't think he's a human being. When he's not saving the world, he's in his restaurants. So right. It's like, when are you, I think he sleeps like this. Like when he's just like, you
with a cigar.
Meeting with him, he's on a Zoom.
And with
he's
a cigar.
Asleep. He's just, yeah, with a cigar.
I mean, I went to Miami for the Palms and for Bobby Flay, and Mike was one of the cooks there. Really cool. But Mike was like, Tall, come out with me tonight. So I went out, and I think we went to the SLS or something, and Jose was cooking out there. And
like holding court.
Yeah.
He's and just like, got like everyone that was in, like, it's almost
everyone
like it's
was
crazy
there.
Because it was as hard as like getting into like, I don't know, like one over whatever.
For sure.
There's like an event happening. It's like everyone wanted to get in, but it was like just all the chefs. Like everyone
yeah,
wanted to be
crazy.
There.
Like I'm sitting there, and it's just me and Mike and Jose Andreas, and which, by the way, I never knew you worked for him. And then he started bringing up stories, and like you guys started talking, and the mutual respect is really cool.
He's the reason that I moved to LA. I came here to open the bazaar for him at the SLS Hotel in Beverly Hills.
What made you want to cook, Mike? Like, is it just because you're like, oh, it's a fucking job, and then it turned into an art for you?
I think I wanted to do something creative, but I've never been like, and I wanted to entertain. Like, I knew that there was a part of me, like, I was always downstairs in the living room trying to get attention and stuff like that. But I'm not good at singing or acting or any of that stuff. I can't paint, draw, play music. But when I started learning how to cook, I started appreciating like the different, your ability to like manipulate and change and tweak and make different, like some, like for instance, I hated vegetables growing up. I was such a picky eater. I ate nothing. Yeah. I'm the kid that sat at the dinner table like this for hours.
Potatoes
and
meat.
My mom just wouldn't let me get up and I would just be there. And finally, I'm like, yo, if I don't like cauliflower and I learn how to cook it so that I like it, then if I make it in a way that I like it, people that like cauliflower are going to love it. And so I started approaching everything that way. And then I started to develop my own palate. But yeah, I just, for me, it was like a creative outlet. Mm. And when I was in high school, I moved out of my house when I was 16 years old. I had an apartment. I had to pay rent. So I was going to school full time, high school, playing football and working a full-time job all at the same time. So it was for survival in the beginning.
Right. It's crazy. Like coming, you know, like kids like us, we come from nothing and no money. And we grew up around some people that had it. And it's like the hustle is so much different because you're like, I could play football, but I also got to get a job and you got to work that job. And you have like no hours in the day for like any personal life.
Our days become extended longer right. because we want to do all the things that all those people get to do. But at the same time, we have to do things to get to do it. So it's
absolutely.
Like the balance, there's no balance. It's just, you're always on the clock.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk some important stuff. How in the fuck did the Top Chef thing happen? How did you get chosen to be a part of it? How did you, and by the way, everyone, it was Mike and his brother going toe to toe.
Yeah.
How did
so I was this. I was at the bazaar as the executive chef of the restaurant, and Marcel Vigneron was the sous chef there. And Marcel was a previous contestant on Top Chef. And I noticed, like, Jose and I would be standing at the pass. That's where the food goes out in front of the whole rest of the restaurant. And these guests were constantly coming up to Marcel, like, "Can I take a picture with you? Oh my gosh, it's such an honor to meet you, chef." And Jose, like, I'm looking at Jose, like, "What is
this? Is your restaurant?"
And I said to Marcel, like, I had watched Marcel on it. Like, I was a fan of his. Like, I thought he was somebody that showed up and represented something slightly different and blah, blah, blah. But I was like, what's up with this Top Chef thing? And he's like, well, you should do it. And I'm like, I will do it. And I'll win this time. Like, and like, we got in this whole like little kind of, not like an argument about it, but just like a little rivalry. And so he introduced me to the producers and we started talking. And that's the same time the James Beard Foundation had put out their Best New Restaurant, their nominations. So Bazaar was nominated for Best New Restaurant, and Volt, my brother's place in Frederick, was nominated for Best New Restaurant. So the producers were like, "Hey, you got a brother, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And they're like, "Maybe you should tell him to apply for this too." And like they I think the story started forming itself at that point.
That's crazy. What year is this?
This was 11 years ago. So 2000, I don't know.
And it was pretty young, right? Season wise.
Season 6.
Yeah. Season 6.
And it was actually in Vegas where you guys are now.
Yeah. And, one of the judges said that,
Tom Colicchio.
Yeah. That Mike was one of the most talented. He said, "You are the most talented chef that's come through this show." So that's, it's pretty kind of gnarly, Mike. You know, for someone respected like him, you know, to say things like that.
How did
Wade? You know, when Tom says it, like Tom for me as the host of that show is so real. Like there was nothing. Tom, like I remember one day there was a relay race and it was like shucking clams. No one in there could shuck clam. Like I can shuck a clam, but a lot of people there couldn't even shuck a clam. And Tom was like watching this and he's like, you know what? Off camera, like he's like, you guys are like, this is embarrassing. He took a clam, held it in one hand with a knife and just went like that. And the thing just opened up and I'm just like.
Oh, so like after you win Top Chef, what's that really do to you? Does it change the whole world? Or like, you know, because you said that the previous chef was getting noticed, but it kind of changed your whole, the whole.
Well, that time, that season, a lot of people were watching that show. I think our finale had over 3 million people watching it. And they won an Emmy that year too. So for a short period of my life, I was walking around like through airports and stuff, like getting recognized and things like that. And that part of it was weird and kind of cool at the same time. But what I was trying to do, because I saw an opportunity in television, I'm like, okay, there's chefs and then there's people that play chefs on TV. How do you connect those dots together? Like there's TV personalities and real cooks. And here's a platform where you can, because we like, you guys know the food and beverage business doesn't make a lot of money unless you incorporate some form of, whether it's nightlife or some other engaging thing that makes people want to keep coming back. And so I saw television or entertainment as an opportunity for chefs to make more money for the amount of work that they do, but also not just make more money, but have a platform to create more opportunities for themselves.
Mm, that's fucking crazy. So in 2011, you opened your first restaurant, correct?
Inc.
I remember I went to the opening. It was fucking crazy. And honestly, I never had any of Mike's food, so I was really excited. And Mike's food was different. You know, it wasn't like and by the way, we'll get to like what kind of foods Mike can cook, but it was I remember sitting there and it was like, it was kind of like a movie scene, you know, when you're like, remember in Demolition Man when Sylvester Stallone goes to like Taco Bell and they're like super like super artsy, and I was like, what the fuck are we eating? You know,
it's like a Visa commercial where he's like, my sister makes little hamburgers.
In 2012, GQ named you best restaurant.
Yeah. It was funny because when Jim Nelson called me, he was the editor or, you know, the head guy at the time. He's like, hey, listen, this is Jim from GQ. And I'm like, hey, how's it going? He's like, I just wanted to congratulate you on winning Best New Restaurant this year. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, like, this is like one of my buddies just hitting me up. I'm like, who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And then he said the most, like when you're not believing something like that, but then you hear him say why, he's like, look, it wasn't the most technically perfect restaurant and it wasn't the most luxurious, whatever. He went through all the things that were wrong with it. He was just like, but I just really had a good time.
The vibe.
And so for me, that was like, okay, he didn't understand, or he understood. We did something to like make him feel something. And that's what the restaurant was about. It was like taking food that normally people can't afford or an experience that's a little bit more expensive because of all the extra touches that go into it and making it more accessible via price point, lowering those prices, basically being a nonprofit and then figuring it out. And then as we did it, I had to figure out how to turn it into a real business because now I've got all these guys in the kitchen. And it came down to, there was a private dining room and we were probably losing $30,000 a month at the time we first opened. Like it's no joke. And this is my first restaurant and I've got an investor and one that's really good in business. And so he's asking questions. So I added like 6 more tables to that area and took out the private part and opened it up.
Yeah.
And those 6 tables became the profitability for the restaurant. And then we felt that momentum and then we got addicted to that. Wait, we can do this, but we can also be a responsible business. So let's figure out how to do both of these at the same time and do it well. And so I got my crash course in being an entrepreneur opening that restaurant.
That's crazy. And I read that space was Michael Ovitz owned it.
Yeah,
he owned the lease on the space. And then his office called me right after Top Chef and said, hey, I'm calling from Michael Ovitz's office. And I didn't know who that was at the time. And I'm like, and at that time I was getting a lot of calls like that. And so obviously you just like Google it.
Yeah.
I Google it. And I'm like, oh shit.
The founder of CAA.
I met him at the house and he was really cool about it. He's like, we negotiated a little bit. He's a notorious negotiator. But then finally he called me one day and he's like, okay, what do you need to get this done? I'm like, I need X amount of dollars wired to an account. And I need to just go and build this restaurant. I need you to support me and let me do what I think I can do.
Yeah.
And he did it and he let me do it. And so Mike has always been someone who represents artists.
Yep.
And so for me, having someone like that in my corner while I'm trying to like emerge in an industry that is creative, he was not just like a person with money. He was somebody that could advise me in certain ways too. And so that was like, and he still is. Like I just was texting with him yesterday. He's That's still crazy. Like a valuable asset for me.
That's so cool. Awesome. For those that don't know who Michael Ovitz is, he was the founder of CAA, a creative genius. He was the super agent of super agents and started an agency. Matt and I actually read his book. And
who is Michael Ovitz?
Yeah. It's great.
Did you read the part where it was like, and then the dust settles or whatever, and I realized I'm the Terminator. Like the whole thing is chapter.
I mean, this man, I mean, marketing genius. I mean, one thing you guys should know, the Coca-Cola Polar Bears, that was Michael Ovitz.
Yeah.
One of the most legendary things for Coca-Cola as a company and a brand. That was that man right there.
A lot of your favorite.
And he always had ideas like that. I remember him one day like saying something like, why don't they advertise on eggshells? And I'm like, that's brilliant because everyone goes to the market and opens it up to look at the eggs.
100%.
Like, somebody should start advertising on those. And I'm just like,
fucking genius. Yeah, genius.
We're taking that. No one get that. That's copyright. Yeah.
That's amazing. Mike, what would you say your style of cooking is?
I mean, I definitely think it has to change even more now, so given the circumstances that we're facing.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to take familiar flavors, like things that people had. Like, I didn't want to do something just for the sake of doing it. Like, I promise you, peanut butter and anchovies are delicious together. Take my word for it. And people have to feel like they had to like it to be cool. So I wanted to take things that flavor-wise normally went together, but then just manipulate the texture a little bit or the visual experience of it a little bit or do something a little bit different. But when people were closing their eyes and chewing it, they still appreciated what they were eating and still felt like they were being fed. And so, and not just fed something that they had to like hold their nose to swallow.
Right.
Because I've had that experience too in some of the most expensive restaurants in the world. I remember once I was given this firefly squid that had all the guts and stuff inside of it. And I was instructed to put the whole squid in my mouth, chew it up, and then drink a shot of sake while I was doing it. And this is a $600 dinner probably. And I did everything I could to not lose it at that moment.
That's crazy. That's how Abby is with oysters.
We had somebody actually at Mini Bar when I was working for Jose. Somebody sat, it was a 6E restaurant in DC at the time, Mini Bar. And this woman sat down. She was so excited. She's like, I'm trying everything tonight. I don't care. I'm so excited to be here. And we were like so stoked to cook for her because when you get to cook for someone, like, so she's like, and we're like, all right, here's the oyster with, I think it had like an apple air or something like that on top of it. And she just, and there's three people on both sides and we're on the other side of the counter serving the dishes. She goes, and then just
projectile. Boof. Oh my God.
And we were all just like, what do we do? Like, oh shit, what do we do? We're just froze. And the other guests are just like,
you're just looking at her.
And this one busser came in and like a fucking superhero just like saved the day. He just came like it happened every day at that time. Like he just came in. And
yeah.
And then everyone sat down and everyone was good to go. No one brought up the rest of the meal. Like some of those people are strangers, but they're having dinner together. And this woman just expressed herself all over the table, her appreciation for the oyster. And it was just, it happens.
Crazy.
So Abby's she's good. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no, we she took me to a restaurant when I first moved to Vegas because she knows I love sushi and there's a Michelin star ratings restaurant here in Vegas, super small, probably as small as this room, and I forget the name. We went there and the chef, like, I was fucking pumped, and they're like are you guys allergic to anything? And I was like, nope, we're good for everything. And you know, like, I say that and then like the first thing comes out, I'm like, ooh, I'm like, yeah, I'm allergic to that. You know, like, I just remember, like, I was like,
when they break out the cod sperm, that's when the allergies come. Yeah. They're like, this is, I had that once, tempura cod sperm.
Oh.
And I'm like, and me as a chef, I'm sitting there and I'm like, how did they get this out? I'm like, I said to the chef, I'm like, how did they get this out of the cod? And he goes like this.
Wow.
But obviously that's not how they do it.
No, of they're course. Not, I just remember she was.
They're not jerking off codfish to get the sperm out, but.
No.
Then I'm like, why don't you serve caviar on top of it and call it an intercourse?
Ooh, see? But that's where you're like the flavor king.
I like that.
The intercourse. I do love oysters now, but before that, I remember I would take, like, I took an oyster, slurped it, and Diet Coke straight shot, right?
Abby, I bet that was delicious.
Abby took it, and the chef is staring at her, and, like, she's thinking, she's like, mm-mm. I'm like, don't you fucking dare spit that shit out right now. And she's like, mm-mm. And she picks up her napkin, and he's just looking at us. And I was like, wow, that had to have been like a disrespect thing.
I always wonder that on those travel shows, like those cooking travel shows where they like go to those other countries and they're sitting there with those people and they're like eating it. And I'm like, oh, some of the
dude, I had a travel channel show where I went to conflict zones around the world, and I would cook in conflict zones and bring the two opposing sides together around the dinner table. I was in either Myanmar or Cambodia. I can't remember. But there was a woman sitting there. There was a lady on the side of the road, like this blue light and this boiling cauldron. And we sat down because it was like visually appealing for the show. And it was, and she was basically cooking all pig parts. And so the first one was like pig eyeball. And so like, you got to do this. Okay. Oh, so I did it. You bite it. The juice like squirts in your mouth or whatever. And then I get this part and they're like asking me, do you know what this is? And I'm like rubbing my tongue on the roof of my mouth, and like, this is really familiar. And it was called pig roof of mouth. That's what they gave me. They cut this part out of the inside of the top part. And like, when you rub your tongue on the top of your mouth right now, feel that like hard part.
I'm like,
imagine chewing on that and all cartilagey and stuff. And so, that was pretty nasty. But I also ate like tarantula, rat, ants.
Yeah, you just got it. And you can't like, it's like super disrespectful if you spit it out. So you just got to like kind of take it.
Well, the reason being is because those alternative proteins were there during times that they just didn't have access to meat. And so it became necessity. And now all of a sudden it's novelty. So you go there and there's like fried tarantula on a stick covered in like chili powder. And people are like walking around taking selfies with the tarantula and stuff like that. Meanwhile, like, for people that had to experience those times and still experience those times, that's food.
Yeah.
Like, we take pictures of like, look at this jar of caviar.
Yeah, right.
So after you opened Ink, you eventually opened up another restaurant, right? Right down the street.
Ink Sack.
Yeah, right next. Well, we actually opened that first. And the reason being was we didn't have our permit to open the restaurant. And so there was a churro stand there next door. And I went in one day and the guy, like, it was like, he had like a warming, like one of those warming cabinets and like one churro inside of it. You walk in, he's just like this. And I just went in and I'm like, hey, I want to help you out. I need to do something. Is there a dollar amount where I could take the space, you know, and help you and help me and blah, blah, blah. And so he came up with some ridiculous number and I offered him a portion of that. He said, yes, I think he grabbed the churro thing and walked out. And, because they weren't making them there. It was just like a retail store and they were coming from somewhere else. And so it wasn't.
That's called laundering money, everyone.
Yeah, some side hustle.
Suspect as fuck.
Yeah. But I took, I think, like $86,000 in my own hands and basically like renovated that whole shop and opened it. And like day one, there was a line down the street. So we were really blessed to like pull that off. But I did it because I had been sitting on ink finished, built out, and I had no income. Like, I wasn't making any money. And so we were making all the lunch meats and stuff inside the kitchen at Ink and wheeling it down the street to Ink Sack, which was the sandwich shop at the time.
Right. And Bobby Hundreds did the logo for that?
Yeah, he did. It's actually.
Yeah, right there.
There it is.
The Ink Sack. Bobby Boy. It's awesome. It's good. So at that time, like, you're super known. Everyone knows you. You're driving a Lamborghini. That's how I met Mike, just so we're all.
It was a Lamborghini. This was true. This is not false.
I was working for the brand. Like, I was an ambassador. I was cooking. So they were launching their 50-year anniversary, and so I was cooking all their events. So yes, I got to drive Lamborghinis, but no, I wasn't like selling that many sandwiches. I'm gonna go get a Lamborghini.
Damn,
but Mike was showing Uncle Polly's what it's really like. Were you frightened, Mike? Like, because like you knew, like, a lot of people were looking at you, especially in the food world, of like, what's up with this kid? You know, and like, not open yet, no income. You're like, this fame's cool, but I got nothing going on.
Even yeah, though you, I mean, there's a lot of
building so much shit at that moment.
There was a lot of pressure, and then there's also a lot of sort of animosity towards me because, like I said earlier, like I was trying to bridge that gap, and I feel like at that time it was still like a touchy subject. Like, do you go cook on TV? And if you're one of those people, then you're labeled as that guy from Top Chef or that guy from television. And so, yeah, I felt a huge responsibility. In fact, when we opened Inc., Irene Verbilia gave me a not great review. Like, it was terrible.
Who is she? So people.
She was the LA Times food critic at the time, who Jonathan Gold had replaced and all that. But she wrote this, like, I thought we were doing a great job. And she wrote a review that basically had, like, nothing to do with the restaurant. It was like, Michael Voltaggio stands up like a carnival barker, inviting the women in drones to come and take a picture with him and blah, blah, blah. It was like, not a restaurant review. It was more like she wanted to be the first person to like
to talk shit.
Me out.
Yeah,
that's.
And I remember feeling like that when I read it. But then I'm like, you know what? If a guest felt that way, then there was something about the experience that was making her feel that way. And so I just like basically wrote her a message and thanked her for the review and said, clearly I have a lot to work on. And I used it as an opportunity not to feel bad about what I had done, but to like, and not really focus on any truth that she had put into it, but just do some research and say, okay, I really got to listen to my guests because I own this place now. And she, as her critic, is still one of the guests. But then like the GQ thing happened. Also Food and Wine magazine recognized me as best new chef that year. So I just remember, I think I actually called Jose. I was really frustrated about the review. And he's like, look, you're not going to win them all. He's like, you have a great restaurant. You just came off of that TV show. You did really well. You won this and this and this. One review is not going to change your career. So don't worry. Don't read into that too much.
That's that shit where you don't go to sleep and you start dealing with depression, you know, like, cause one, I've dealt with that. One person will talk down on me whether it's a friend or anyone. And you're just like, but I'm just trying to do my best. And people aren't taking it as serious as you're taking what that person said. You know what
Especially
I mean?
Especially when it's printed in the press, like it's in the
100%.
Press. Yeah. And it's like, there's a lot of great press out there and I appreciate every bit of it, but I think there's a lot of outlets out there sometimes that write a lot to sort of just get the story.
Oh yeah,
and
clickbaits.
Like, yeah, and I mean, a lot of it, even like, I mean, I love Eater and I love, you know, a lot of the stuff that they do cover, but some of the stuff during COVID has been like, these are all the restaurants that are going to be shut down because of COVID or like whatever. And I know that that's important news, but at the same time, I feel like.
But is it like
the industry need to like support each other a little bit more, you know, like without Eater, there's no us, without us, there's no Eater. So there has to be a time where everyone just sort of says, okay, everyone come together and fix this problem. Let's not point fingers at the people that are doing it the wrong way because we're all trying to figure out how to do this.
It's like Eater could do such a good job of explaining everyone that restaurants operate at such a small, like, you know, overhead that they don't really, not small overhead, but operating costs. They don't have a lot of money to like take time off or close down. You know, there's not a lot of loose cash for them to make.
Or do it twice, three times.
Yeah.
Right.
So like,
absolutely.
Eater could take this platform themselves to like, really explain to people like, hey, you should order out from these places. Or when they do open up, make sure you go and visit and,
people
and
don't,
tip heavy.
Yeah.
You know?
People don't know, you know, cause we have done such a good job at blinding people with showing everybody how perfect life is, you know, that this goes down and people don't understand, like, just because takeout's killing it for you does not mean shit. You know what I mean? Like, you're probably
because you have the extra cost of paying whatever service you use for the takeout. You had to relearn how to, packaging is not cheap. You know, you can't just put everything inside of a grocery bag and just throw it at someone. Like, especially if you're trying to do it at a certain level, like you have standards that people need to perceive when they get that experience.
Right. What do you think's next for the cooking world, Mike? Like, obviously this is kind of like, you know, over the last 3 years, I've become super close with Vetri and Michael Simon, right? And they speak so highly of you. I mean, you can listen to our podcast. We talk about you, you know, I think Mark Vetri was our first, he was our first guest. And, you know, we were talking about like the new generations of cooks, which we put you in there. We put John and Vinny in there, you know, Felix, you know, stuff like that. And like, you know, Mike and Mark and Bobby and them, they're from like the old school days, right? Like, what do you think's next in your world?
Well, I think a lot of us need to start going back to those guys who were there before there was so much hype around restaurants and pick their brains a little bit more and figure out how they, what the old ways were like, because right. we are in the business of like, we see a restaurant space, we go in and take it over, we change it and we try and get it open. We just throw some marketing behind it and there it is. And that exercise is so relevant every year. We do that in a different space. We do that. Well, now our entire industry has to do that. Because now our entire industry is broken and out of business. And now our entire industry needs to come together and figure out how to rebuild it in a way. Because the marketing behind it's going to be super important. Why? Because we're dealing with people's health now. Like, one bad story about something that happened, it used to be about like salmonella or E. coli or whatever. Right. I got food poisoning was like, people would call and like, I'm going to sue you. I've been shitting for 2 hours. And you're just like... And now it's like, hey, it's potentially life-threatening. And so we have to now, people that work in the food service industry, which back in the day, like, we weren't, like, it was like, okay, I need a job. Like, I barely got through high school. So we're having to study and learn all about the ins and outs of what this pandemic is really all about, and make sure that we're providing an environment, not only where the guests feel safe, but our staff, our teams. Because they're really, like, if you look at the medical professionals, you know, the frontline workers in the restaurants are the people that are standing tableside. And they are so compromised too, not only because they're coming in and commuting to work and around so many different people every day, but there's also the factor, there's people that still won't even cover their fucking face right now.
Right. Like, dude, it's insane. The most simple shit ever. And you still like have a problem with it.
And it's not, I mean, like for me in the beginning, I was like, I would forget the mask, but now it's like where my shoes are. Like, I don't forget my shoes. I don't forget my keys. I don't forget my fucking mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got like 10 of them in my car. It's like everywhere I look now, there's masks. I got them in my backpack.
Oh, I'm going to send you a bunch when we get off, Mike. Yeah, I'm going to send you some hats and some bad news.
But you know, thank you. But you know, what's funny though, is like when something is trendy and trending, everyone wants a piece of it. Like, if they marketed masks the way they marketed off-white shoes, maybe we wouldn't be having this, like, conversation right now.
Fucking
like, everyone
right.
has to have it.
Yeah.
And now, being anti-mask, for some reason, there's these whatever percent of people that think it's, like, this is not, you can't take away my rights. Like,
right.
It's like they got to make
it. But everyone's doing it. Yeah. Like, if just follow what everyone else is. Look cool for once. Just look
crazy.
Cool. Put the mask on.
Yeah, don't have to worry about how you look. Just cover this whole thing up.
Literally.
And speak with your
that
eyes.
That part of it's actually really cool. You notice it here, like in LA, you walk by and you're like, is that? And you're like, I don't know. They're living their best life. Like,
of course. I mean,
like a lot of the people that live in LA, the celebrities and stuff are like, I want to see what grocery shopping is like.
Yeah,
right.
I haven't done this in a while.
I'm going to go there. My brother had it. He had a rough couple first days, and then, but he was chasing it. Let's be real. My brother was like, where is Corona? Miami? And he's like,
there.
He sent me a photo. I'm like, where are you going? He's like, $300 for first class round trip, bitch. We're good. I was like, okay. Comes home 3 days later. I feel like,
but now is he like now saying like, yo, this shit is real. Like everyone out there that's doing what I did.
Look, as we know, Tav is so young, so like he's just like he's already out partying again. You know, he's like the fools at the fucking.
This is where you got to be a big brother,
bro. He ain't listening to shit. He doesn't listen to anyone but Tav, and he was like, "I had it. I'm cool. I went to a house party the other day. Some girl got my name tattooed on her ass, and I was like, you're probably gonna get it again." He's like, "Wait, you can get it again?" I was like, "Yeah, they're finding out that you can." He's like, fuck. I'm like, dude.
Oh, man.
He was more worried about being in his house for 2 weeks than having this thing.
You guys should get off this podcast, drive to LA, and whoop his ass right now. That's it. Keep him home.
I'll just send you his address. Roll over there with some homies.
I got
you. Let me call real quick.
Speaking of brothers, you and your brother, you guys are partners, correct?
We are, yeah.
So what spots do you guys have right now, Mike, together?
We have our steak, Voltaggio Brothers Steakhouse, which is at the MGM National Harbor, which is actually open right now and doing well.
Okay, so it is open.
They stepped up and provided a lot of good information for us to do it the right way. And so we're doing that. Estuaries at the Conrad Hotel, that's in the city center of Washington, D.C. That's the whole hotel shut down right now because that hotel is a luxury hotel for like business travelers, and there's just no business. Congress is on recess. There aren't a lot of like other amenities aside from food and beverage in the hotel. And so it just made more sense to not have the hotel open, therefore not having the restaurant open. So we're trying to navigate through that right now. They've been great partners too, but really we're fortunate in the fact that we have two very big partners in our life. And they want and see the future of opening these properties back up because people eventually will want to get out, but also people have to go back to work. Like DC has to open back up.
Right.
Like it's election year. Like this is a hotel blocks away from Pennsylvania Avenue. And we know there's going to be some changes happening over there. Like there's going to be a lot to celebrate. So
Mike, the dining room, that was a spot.
In Pasadena.
Yes. Where you fucking won a lot of awards for being a boss.
So that was when I got back from Top Chef, I had to meet with Jose called me. He's like, meet me at Matsugisa. And when I went to go do
Hold on, real quick. That's a restaurant. Most of you don't know what that is. But Matsuhisa is Nobu.
It's the original Nobu.
It's the original Nobu. That is, I think, where De Niro and Nobu met. And we're like, hey, we should start a restaurant together.
And then they went to New York and opened up the first Nobu in New York.
Yes. And now they're very rich. Now they're very rich. But go ahead.
Yeah, it's funny. I'll tell you a story about that restaurant later, too.
Please.
But I'm sitting there and like with Jose, like Nobu was there basically making our lunch for us. And I had resigned to go do Top Chef because the Bazaar had just opened and Jose didn't think it was a good idea for me to go leave the restaurant. He said to me, you're leaving a newborn child in the middle of the street. But I felt compelled to go do this. Like I needed to do this for myself because I got to a level where we got a 4-star review from the LA Times. I'm running a massive restaurant that generates X amount of revenue per month. I figured out how to do a lot of things I didn't know how to do. So now it was like, what's next? Okay, I'm try television. So I left and did that. And when I did what I did there, I came back and Jose and I met for lunch and he's like, you come back to work. You ready to come back to work? And I'm like, you know, I remembered what was happening in that restaurant with Marcel. And I just didn't want to bring that type of attention because I have so much respect for Jose, like the opportunity
you
gave me out here. So I didn't take my job back. We decided that it wasn't best. And that's when I got the job in Pasadena. And I'm like, I'm going to go out of the center of LA, work in a small restaurant inside of a luxury hotel where there's not going to be a lot of attention and just really focus on cooking. And that's what I did. I was like, I don't want to be caught up in like the ride of this. I want to keep this ride going for another, it's been 10 years now and it's still sort of going. And I think it's because of that. I went back to what I do and that's cook.
Right. I mean, it got a Michelin, do I say it right? Is it a Michelin star?
Yeah, it had one of those.
Right. That's really important in the book of cooking.
Well, you know what it does is it puts a criteria on you. It basically sets the standard of the level in which you need to perform on a daily basis. So when you are Michelin starred or you have a certain responsibility that you have to now operate on that level every day. So when you're trying to get it, you're pushing hard to get it. But then when you get it, it's the game of now maintaining it because you don't want to be the guy that lost it.
Fuck, you can lose it.
Yeah, they can take it away. Next year, they could be like, here's a bit gourmand. Here's some recognition as seen in the guide. But like, you're not, if you have that star, your goal is to keep that one there and add another one and another one. And I got one in Dry Creek Kitchen with Charlie Palmer in 2006 up in Northern California. And I got the one at the Langham in Pasadena. But like, I don't save all that. Like,
no, of course. That's what I love about you. It's like for you, it's like, cool. It's like stuff.
It becomes stress is what it is.
Right.
Like it becomes now something to be measured against. And it's like, I appreciate it so much. And I love the fact that it's an accomplishment, but I don't get complacent with that shit. You know, it's like, you have to be thinking about the next one. And that's why I gave the analogy of like 1 star to 2. I never got 2 stars, but I never put myself in a situation where I think we were going for that. But now I wanted to, now what I'm focusing on is, one, dealing with this whole situation and creating solutions to this massive list of problems that we all have, but creating a sustainable lifestyle for myself and the people that work for us, like creating opportunity even when there's not opportunity. And I think that that's really where every industry has to come together, because we need to learn from each other, especially in hospitality. Like one thing, you know, talking about Vetri and those guys earlier, like this is really an opportunity for younger people to go back to those guys and get help, because
that is amazing.
They're the ones that are actually, they're not hiring people to build fucking partitions. A lot of those guys are in there like,
yeah, it's,
and it's like, that's how you got to do it.
It's so, it's funny he says that, because if you remember, like Michael and Mark, they're like, when we got into this, we didn't get in it for the money, the fame. Yeah, that shit didn't even exist. We did. Yeah. There was no TV shows, you know, none of that. Like, it's funny you say that. Like, I think those guys would appreciate that, because, you know, they're like, we're fossils. I'm like, yeah, but fucking multimillionaires, because the way you did it was you paved that way for this new generation.
Because they worked hard. Yeah. You know what I mean? Nancy Silverton's another one. She's still in there grinding every single day. She, you know, there's so many people in our industry that got to achieve a level of success the easy way. And then there's the ones that went through it the hard way. And I think that to get through this, I hope that a lot of people can appreciate the hard way parts that they had to go through so that they can apply that discipline to what we're going through right now.
Crazy.
And how long were you in Northern California for, Charlie Palmer?
I was there for almost 2 years. And
have you been back to Healdsburg since?
Yeah, that town is blowing.
It's blown up, right? It's crazy. I'm from Santa Rosa, so it's close. It's like the one right below it. So
I lived in Windsor, which is, yeah, okay, right, yeah.
Right in the middle. Yeah, so boom.
What?
I love it. Yeah, it was good. Charlie actually lives out that way too. But Charlie's another one. He's another one that should be on that list of when I worked for Charlie at Dry Creek. The ice machine was broken one day. There was no ice in it. And Charlie's like, come on, there's no fucking ice in the fucking ice machine. Like, what? And like, I'm like, Chef, it's broken. He goes, go get me a screwdriver. And he's just goes like, does, and then like an hour later, it's full of ice. And I'm just like, he's like, call the fucking ice repairman or whatever and tell him not to come. And I'm like, that's what we have to do right now. We got to fix the ice machine. Boom. Ourselves.
Wow. That's the fucking tagline. We got to fix the ice machine.
Shit.
Damn, Mike. What's next for you and your brother, or for you?
We are ironically enough looking at some properties that are under construction that have restaurants in their portfolio or in their plans, in various different parts. Some closer to here in LA, but out of the city. But we're focusing a little bit more too on the entertainment aspect. So we've got a couple TV projects that we're going out with Brian and I now after this last appearance of him on Top Chef again. We really want to do something together. And I think as much as I hate to be like, content is so important. I used to believe that like the distribution or the ability to distribute content was more important than the actual content that was being distributed. But now everyone is getting content sent to them. So now the content itself is important again. So it's like, we want to create good information and entertaining information and really just put something else out there that if we're all going to be sitting at home, people can enjoy. And if it's about food, that's really kind of the way we're going to go with it. So
there's something really cool about family too. So I think it'll be huge for you guys doing it together.
Brother.
Yeah. And then a lot of it is just putting our industry back together and really trying to understand what that looks like and how to mentor people that are coming up now. Cause now I'm becoming one of the old guys.
Got it.
It's weird. Like Arjun Knuckle have Badmash here in LA. And I'm like, that's like this young kind of hip fire Indian restaurant that's here. And it's like, they're like, you're the old school. And I'm like, no, I'm not.
Fuck, don't say that.
Like, we look up to you so much. I'm like, don't. We're the same. Like,
yeah. Please don't look up to me.
I don't want to be in a category like that yet. Like, but because
you're so young, but yet been in the game for so long. It's so fucking crazy.
25 years.
Yeah, man.
Most people like they get pension after that.
Right. Yeah. Right. And retires.
I don't even get the stimulus. Like, where's
what's that? Yeah.
I got to go back to work.
Fuck, man. That's crazy.
So eventually, too, I did read that you had a sous chef that won Top Chef, too, right?
Mei Lin.
Actually, yeah. I had, Mei Lin won Top Chef. Hung worked for me. He won Top Chef. Oh. Kevin Spraga worked for me. He won Top Chef.
Note to self, yeah. Go work for Mike Voltaggio if you want to be on Top Chef and win Top Chef.
And I'm not saying it has anything to do with me at all. It doesn't. But all those people that won were programmed to focus on cooking. And I think that's, you know, I was asked the question yesterday, what advice would you give to someone that would be a part of like a reality show or whatever? And I'm like, a lot of times people use reality TV as an opportunity to like, they think they're being casted to be an actor. So they go there and they play someone completely different than who they are, but it's, you should just go be yourself. Like that's really what everyone wants. And I think a lot of those people, they did it on their own. They just went and they did it themselves. They didn't try and go and be something that they're not.
Wow. Well, that's crazy. Fucking crazy. Your story is kind of crazy. You're kind of a big deal.
Nah. I'm a line cook, man. I'm a line cook.
You know, it's so funny too, because at Family Style, you're like the MC of the whole thing.
Dude.
So, and I was like, man, he's so
Matt
outspoken.
Always talks about that, yeah.
He's just up there on the stage just hyping everybody. Going, like a bunch go get this. Yeah. You haven't eaten this. You should try this. And I was just like, man, I think that really like, you don't see that in chefs too much. You know, like they're good at selling their product or like, you know, like BAM or, you know, whatever it might be. But you have such a like a way to like
everyone likes
it's like so energizing too. It's fun to watch and outspoken.
What's funny though, as a chef, like when you cook food for someone and you send it to them, they get to eat it and taste it, appreciate it, and they have that connection with you. And then when you're in an environment where you've got a lot of people, like Bottle Rock is a music festival I do every year, we have to get creative. There's a culinary stage there, and we've got this crowd of people like that are there for a music festival. They can't eat the food that you're making, so you have to create this demo that will keep them engaged. And so, like, I got to set a world record with Snoop and Warren G one year, make chicken, fried chicken with Flavor Flav, jumped around on stage with Everlast from House of Pain on the Stomping Graves.
Yeah.
Like, brum, brum, brum. We're in the hospitality industry, and I think part of that is having this innate ability to want to make people feel good. And so for me, I'm super chill. Like we're sitting at home, my girlfriend's sitting next to me now. She's like, I like how you can kind of do both, because there's other people that are entertainers that are always like, you're just like, bro, can you just dial it down right now? Like I'm watching,
go in the other room, please.
I'm watching the Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix. Like I don't need you to like be doing a bit right now. And it's like, we have our time together to chill, but also, and she owns her own company too. So she gets like the work-life balance. And part of to do that, sometimes it's just letting out a bunch of aggression and energy. But other times it's because I'm like, okay, these people are expecting something from me. I'm not cooking for them, but I have to exceed that same expectation.
Mm. Man.
Sorry, I just got a fucking text. I just want to blow my brains out.
I get at least 6 of those a day.
Oh, it's one of those like texts where you're reading it and then you're already answering like, I fucking told you to fucking do that a month ago.
Yeah. you just push the all caps button so they get it.
Oh, it's already all caps when I talk to people anyways, because I'm just like, I feel like sometimes like no one's listening and then it's too late by the time you're like,
the funniest thing is, if you ever text him back, he'll be like, quit yelling. And you're like, Zach, text him.
You know what the best thing to do is start to write it so the dot, dot, dots go through and then.
Oh, the clouds. Yeah, the clouds. I do that all the time. I do the clouds.
I would have fucking. And then just nothing. <nothing. Yeah.
laughs> Copy and paste, and then just maybe I'll send it later.
Fuck. Well, Mike, last question. What does success mean to Mike Voltaggio?
You know, it's going to sound scripted because I've asked this question a long time ago and I wanted to have the perfect response.
Yeah.
And so for me, and I'll associate this with like, I do a lot of cycling. Success to me is enjoying the view from the climb. A lot of people think that like, once you get up there, that's the part that you're like,
I did it.
Yeah. But it's like, to me, you have to have, when you're doing this, that has to be more important to you, because once you get up there, you spend less time up there.
100%.
And you just shoot back down the other side. And that's the part of success that really success, not up there. It's enjoying this, stopping here for a moment, and then really fucking enjoying the easy part. But it never gets easy. I haven't gone this way
never.
Yet. I'm sweating my fucking ass off right now trying to get up there, but I love it. That's it.
Yeah. That's actually a great answer, because you're so right. Like, everyone's had that like moment, you know, you think you got to your pinnacle of your career or whatever, and you're like, man, this is so cool, and then like with a matter of minutes it's like it's gone, you know,
because
like,
you look
how up, I get back up there
else,
yeah,
somebody else just went right past you.
Of course yeah, it's crazy. Yeah
but also I think you need to take people with you too, and I think that's probably always the most important part.
100%.
You're not going up that hill by yourself, and I think that when you appreciate other people's success, and you see it in fashion, you see it in music, you see it in my industry, people hate people that worked for them that become successful. They find it like, how dare you become successful because I was successful and you worked with me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the trade-off of like working long hours for somebody else and being there with them when they needed you. It's like, okay, one day you're gonna reap the benefits and you might not be able to afford to pay me what I think I'm gonna be worth, but because I worked with you, my worth is gonna go up, and you should encourage that. And I think that a lot of people that own businesses, they get all like, they get mad at their
right. Oh my God, resentful. Are you kidding me? I've been by the sides of many who fucking they shit on you so hard. You know, they never want to see you shine, or they pretend like they do, and they never have your back. They never talk about you, and it's like your whole life, you're like sitting there like supporting everyone, talking about everyone, giving stuff. Like I've come to a place in the last few months where I'm like, I need to stop loving so much, you know, I need to stop caring as much as I do, because no one, and that's real, there's not many out there besides a circle that we're in, Mike, or, you know, some that will show as much love as we show other people. It's fucking,
you're not going to be able to stop doing that though.
Yeah. It's mind boggling though, because it makes me want to cry. I'm like,
because I know you're not going to do it. You're going to go do 100 things today before you fucking like, what time is it? We're finishing up our first meeting at 11:15.
Yeah.
Not that that's early,
yeah,
but that's early for LA.
Yeah. You know, that's why I try to teach Tav. I'm like, man, like, there's many ways of looking at success, right? And it's like, I'm not rich, Tav, you know, like, I'm not, you know, like, and because he's like so focused on like, Tav will be on that, you know, 30 under 30 for Forbes within next year. He's 24 years old, and he's just like, I'm going after everyone, and I'm gonna.
But we're still those kids that are those people that are still having to work those extra hours to be able to stay there. And that's the 100%. Part, like, it doesn't stop. It doesn't, it never just becomes easy. Like, and if it does, I don't know. You did it right.
Yeah,
I don't know what you did. Send me the recipe though.
Right.
Yeah. It's
crazy. But you know, there's the people that care about money and the people that care, like I said, like success is different for everyone. You know what I mean? Where it's like, I'm not a millionaire yet. And for some reason I didn't take that road. I didn't make that right.
You made some people millionaires.
Yes,
along the way, you know,
very lots of millionaires.
So
lots of millions.
That's kind of something to be said.
3 million sold. It's right behind you.
That's. I mean, but these guys, you know, they're fucking responsible for a lot of my career. So
yeah,
I have a lot of these plaques for Mike. Actually, I have one in the hallway that says 70 million.
His whole Instagram feed is him working.
He doesn't stop working. He's my idol. He doesn't stop working. Mike doesn't know how to stop working. Mike Shinoda is a fucking, wait, what? There's only 24 hours in the day? Actually, there's like 37. I'm like, what?
But they're a great example of how to not just build a band, but build a brand, because 100%. They controlled the visual aspect of every single thing they did too. And that's another, like, you have to, you can't just be like, I don't know, I want it to be purple, and then go back to it and be like, yeah, that's great. It's like, you have to have your hands in all of it for all of it to work together somehow.
For sure.
And those guys just...
Yeah. We have a circle of friends that are just like, it's crazy. Like, people grow up and they're like, that's my idol. And I'm like, that's my life coach. You know, like someone like Bobby, you know, it's like, Bobby can't stop working. It's just you. You know, it's just like, we don't know.
Ben and Bobby are, I mean, yeah, we had a meeting down at their HQ a couple of weeks ago, and I just... It'll just be the two of them inside that massive place. Still work. I'm like, what are you guys doing here? They're like,
gotta work. Offices.
Yeah, we're working.
Hey, so one last question. I always do this in honor of James Lipton. He used to inside the actor's studio. And he used to ask the question, is number 5, is what's your favorite curse word? And I just want to know, what do you,
I don't curse. Oh,
man, I think, Sammy, what's my favorite curse word? You probably hear it the most. It's probably the F word, right? It's probably fuck.
Nice.
Like, fuck. Because it's like, fuck yeah, or like, fuck.
Fuck.
Like, fuck you. Like, there's, you can apply it to any situation.
Oh, yeah. That's the most functional word in the English language.
Yeah.
Crazy. Functional.
Functional. Functional.
Functional.
I like it.
Mr. Mike.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate you.
Thank
you
so much.
Love you guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mikey. I'll
have a great day.
I'll talk to you.
Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Out.
Thanks, later. Mike.
Bye, guys.
Bad news. Fuck going on.
That's just terrible. Bad news.